Ere Tove, Bruchim Abayim, good evening and welcome to the Kaspari Center's Open Lecture. I have the pleasure today to introduce to you Thorleif Engvin from Norway. Thorleif is professor in Jewish and Biblical Studies in Oslo. But he's not only that, he is a scholar in Qumran studies. He has his PhD from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he is one of the scholars who joined the International Committee for Publishing the Qumran Scroll. And he is more than that also, he is the former leader of the Kaspari Center. And in the end, I will also add, I have been colleague with Thorleif in Norway several years when we were translating the Bible into Norwegian, which was published in 2011. So, Thorleif will speak about priestly messiahs in the Bible and the Dead Sea Scrolls and in Hebrews. But first he will give us an update on the situation on the Dead Sea Scrolls and Qumran. That's why you are in the country, yeah? So, welcome Thorleif.
I'm here for 10 days and together with a colleague from Canada and Southern Norway, sitting on the third bench there, up with Johanke. He's my colleague in Norway, reading and deciphering and interpreting the Norwegian Dead Sea Scrolls. Yes, correctly, the Norwegian Dead Sea Scrolls, because fragments of 30 stone fragments ended up via Bethlehem, Lebanon, Zurich, and into Norway, and we are now in the process of publishing them. And then we needed to compare with their cousins in the collections of the Israel Antiquities Authority located at the Israel Museum. So this week we have been looking on fragments and remnants of scrolls who look very similar to fragments we have in Norway, to see if we can find some matches, not as to specific scrolls, but as to the same way of formatting scrolls, in particular in the first century CE, 30, 40, 50 AD. Then scribes were doing things more carefully than they were doing before, so we have certain different observations. As a text George scholar, I also did something I've not been doing before. I have been collecting mud, Judean desert mud. Earlier when I lived in Israel, I with my family and my boys are often was hiking in Judean desert. So I have been trampling in Judean desert mud earlier, many years ago. But now I was in the archives of the Israel Antiquities Authority at Har Zvim in Jerusalem, and going into boxes of the archaeologists from the 50s and 60s and see if I could still find soil, dirt and dust from the caves that could be taken out as clean samples without my dirty fingers touching them. And these samples will be tested for the mineral composition so that we can know exactly what kind of dusty mineral environment was in the caves of Murabaat and in the caves of Nahal Khebel in the 50s and early 60s, and we can compare that with testing of parchment leather that was found in the same cave, or that we fragments that we suspect we found in those caves. Of course, the Bedouin did not leave us a good record, and so most of these scrolls or fragments of scrolls were found by Bedouin, not by archaeologists. And perhaps their story is correct, perhaps not, and they pass through middlemen. So now then we are trying to trace the provenance of some fragments that we are not sure from where they came from. And tomorrow I will go into the Rockefeller Museum and put my dirty fingers into some boxes there and see if I can find some more soil or dust from boxes that were archived there by Roland de Boer, the leader of the Corps Biblique, back in the 50s and 60s, when he was excavating the caves of Qumran. So, and then So I have been doing things I've not been doing before, and it's fascinating to see that new sciences can help us textual scholars to try to understand more about these environments of ancient Israelite and Jewish scribes and communities just before the another Jewish movement, the Jewish Jesus movement, started to develop in the first century. That was my little introduction of what brought me to Israel these 10 days. And now I'm going to the topic for tonight, Priestly Messiahs in the Bible, Genesis, Scrolls and Hebrews. This is one particular field within Messianism. And if you read a number of influential Old Testament scholars the last 20 years, many of them say that there is no real messianism in the Hebrew Bible. The expectation of a future messiah or person or figure who will bring redemption, that is only a post-Old Testamental feature that you do not find in the Hebrew Bible. I disagree with that. In the autumn, I and my notes will also be launched a web course in English on Messianism in the Hebrew Bible and in early Jewish traditions, and that might be interesting for many of you, and to follow my lectures would be free of charge. So there I will reason why I think there is a Messianism already in the Old Testament, and that then runs smoothly into the what Christians would call the intertestamental period, the second and first century BC, very continuous, especially in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but also in other Jewish writings. But to this evening, I will not talk about the Davidic messianism, the hope for end time son of David. I will talk about the priestly messianism. Is there hope for an end time priestly figure? To my astonishment, the last half year I have found such a figure also in at least one Old Testamental text. I will look at other Old Testamental texts and we see that hopefully this evening. Messiah means, the image here, I will not talk much about it because that is another Messianic text from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Messianic Apocalypse by the scholars called 4:25:21. But those of you who read Hebrew can see the opening line to the right. You see the end of the word Shamayim. The heaven or the hosts of heaven and earth will listen to or obey to his Messiah. Heaven and earth will listen to obey his Messiah. That's the strongest messianic statement we have in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it has been a passage for scholars for some time. I lectured on this text here close to a year ago. And I think this is kind of a heavenly Davidic messiah, and it's remarkably close to one verse in the New Testament, the close to last verse in Matthew. To me is given all power in heaven and on earth. One almost should imagine that Matthew had read this text, or he knew a similar way of thinking about the heavenly Davidic Messiah. But this is the Davidic Messiah, I think, and now I'm going to talk about priestly anointed ones. At least when it comes to Davidic messiahs, or the Davidic messianic thinking, I think something happens after the fall of the kingdom of Judea, the fall of Jerusalem in 587. What I find up to 587 is a hope for a coming son of David in an ordinary earthly image. A new David, perhaps as good as his old David was, and better than Solomon, and even better than Josiah. as the last good king they remember, or Hezekiah. But up to the fall of the temple, they expect a good king. We have a good king in Norway, they have the Norwegian would say that the Swedish king is... yes, I dropped that. But a good king, even better than the Norwegian king, the Judeans expected through the fall of the temple and Jerusalem, and then I sense after the fall of the temple, there is some transformation in the hope of what kind of a Davidic king do we expect. And I think now that it's also some transformation, and that we find after the exile a few texts hoping also for an anointed priest of the end times. In Exodus 29 we have the anointing of Aaron and his sons, the anointing of the priests. So those anointed in the Bible are kings, priests, and I think we have one or two verses also an anointed prophets. Isaiah 61 is an anointed prophet. The Lord has anointed me to preach good news. So from the exile on, I think we have expectations of an end time or coming in the future son of David, who in some texts transcend the image of a normal earthly good king. Some of these texts can be read either symbolically or more concrete, and you have some texts suggesting easily some kind of new creation, renewal of creation, or transformed conditions of nature around this son of David. When they start to build the temple in 520, you find in the book of Ezra, and you find in the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, two main figures. The Davidic Zerubbabel, the grandson of King Jehoiakim, the second last king of Judea, and thus the son of David. And you find as his partner the high priest Joshua Yehoshua. And we have text in Zechariah 4 and 6 who talk very elevated about these two anointed ones. So even if Zerubbabel is not anointed king, he's the governor of Judea, appointed by the Persian king. He is symbolically in the book of Zechariah, he's called the anointed one, as is his companion, the high priest Josiah. And Joshua. And in chapter 4, we have a beautiful vision where the prophet sees a menorah with seven lamps and on both sides two olive trees. And of course, this in by the state of Israel has become an important symbol for the state of Israel. The menorah in the middle and the two olive trees flanking it. And but towards the end of Zechariah 4, the prophet asks the angel, who is his tour guide through these visions, what are these two olive trees at the right of the lamp and at its left? And the lamp and the menorah is a symbol for God's presence. That the prophet had got, even if it did not understand so much more. And then the angel said, these are the two anointed ones who stand before the Lord of the whole earth. Stand before the Lord of the whole earth. And those two anointed ones are Zerubbabel, the governor, the son of David, and Joshua, the high priest. This chapter is usually seen as the origin of a double messianism in Israelite tradition, origin for the later Qumran messianism, where they expect both the Davidic and the priestly Messiah. If we go to chapter 6 in Zechariah, we have another vision followed by interpreting words to the prophet. And in 6:11 to 13, we hear about the shoot, that is the shoot of David, the son of David, and then the priest, and both of them receive a throne in the vision, one for the Davidic and one for the priest. In the first verse, in Hebrews 11, it is written, take silver and gold and make crowns. Some of your Bible translations will say make a crown, but the Hebrew is very clear. Make crowns from silver and gold. Take silver and gold and make crowns, as set on the head of the high priest Joshua, son of Jehozadak. Scholars have wondered why are there crowns first and then only crowning the high priest. In the congregation there are two thrones, one for the priest and one for the Davidic. And one hypothesis by many scholars is that originally there were two crowns and the prophet got a word symbolically. There shall be crowns both for the Davidic Zerubbabel and for the priest. And it will sit on a throne given by God. They are both appointed important servants of God, and now will the new era for Israel unfold. But then the scholars, they wonder, what happened with Zerubbabel? Certainly he's not there anymore. We don't find in the chronicles of Ezra or Nehemiah, and there is a scholar in the audience who knows more about these two books here than I do. They wonder, was it too risky for the Persians to continue to have a son of David as governor? They removed him, or poisoned him, or sent him into exile, or said, we have some more important tasks for you in Persia, or in Uzbekistan, or in China, I do not know, whatever, but we cannot keep you in Jerusalem. And they say perhaps that was the end of Zerubbabel as Davidic governor in Jerusalem. If the one of the two to be crowned by God symbolically disappears, then of course the text is completely changed. So you crown only one of them, and what shall we do with the second crown? Okay, we keep it here in the drawer and see if there become a candidate soon or later to get it. That is a hypothesis by some of the scholars. Now I jump to a text, and I think for the first time I probably have something new to share also with also our Bible scholars in the audience. Jeremiah 30:20-22. I will read this text to you we have it in the Hebrew text, in the Masoretic text. This is end time promise of the renewal of Israel, where the congregation of Israel once more shall stand before God, and their leader shall do something marvelous to renew the relation. Their children shall be as before, and their congregation shall be established before me, and I will punish all who oppress them. Then comes the verse, their nobles shall be from among them, and their governor shall come from their midst. Then I will cause him to draw near, and he shall approach me. For who is he who pledged his heart to approach me, says the Lord? And then, following that, we hear the words of a new covenant. I will say, you shall be my people, and I will be your God. This is the Hebrew text of Jeremiah. And many years ago, I learned from my teacher Hartmut Gese in Tübingen, Germany, that this is the first text on the Davidic Messiah, risks his life as he approaches to sacrifice, or perhaps to be sacrificed before God. And what Brigitte said, this is a text very similar to Zechariah 13:7, "Sword, wake up against my shepherd." And "sword, wake up against my shepherd," that means that the shepherd, the royal shepherd, the son of David, will be killed, and then the flock will be scattered. And as you know, when you come to Mark 14, this verse is quoted by Mark as a key to understand what happens in Gethsemane. "Sword, wake up against my shepherd." And then the flock scatters, the disciples are everywhere. But then I checked into the Septuagint of this verse. As some of you know, we have two very different receptions of the book of Jeremiah in the Second Temple period up to the time of Jesus. And scholars have for a long time said very clearly that the earlier and shorter edition of the book of Jeremiah is preserved by the Septuagint, the Greek Jewish Bible that we have preserved to later Christian sources. And the Septuagint reflects a much shorter Hebrew version of the book of Jeremiah from, I would say, from the, around the year 500, two, three generations after Jeremiah dies in the 580s. The Bible, most of you who are not Greek Orthodox know, that is translated from the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Masoretic text, and that version of Jeremiah is 50% longer, and it is organized differently. And scholars have now for 30 years, at least, they have agreed what some scholars said 150 years ago, that this Hebrew, longer, more elaborate, edited version of Jeremiah is later. So, Jewish scribes, first you have Baruch, Jeremiah's secretary, and you have Deuteronomistic scribes in the school of Deuteronomy, who edit the verse of Jeremiah and produce a Hebrew scroll that I would date to around 500. It grows a couple of generations, and they edit it, and I think they have authority to do it, to interpret it for their generation, their times. And that scroll from around the year 500 or shortly after that, to know what was there, we have to go to the Septuagint. Three out of six substantial scrolls or remnants of scrolls from Qumran preserve copies of the Hebrew version of the Septuagint, very close to that. And on my computer I have a Greek fragment of Jeremiah that is unpublished until a friend of mine at the Ecole Biblique put it into a dissertation a month ago. And I could discuss it for the first time, and I was very pleased that Lukasz Popko, a nice Catholic Polish scholar, could include that in his discussion. And he says, as I do, that this is a Hebrew text very close to the Septuagint. This text is perhaps from 70, 60, 50 BC, but it preserves this earlier, shorter edition of Jeremiah. And then we have three texts who are closer to the longer Masoretic reception, but only one of them is really close to that. But we have three. So we have three texts in Qumran from the early 2nd century BC and from the 1st century BC that are close to the original shorter section of Jeremiah. And we have three texts preserving the longer, more elaborate edition, but only one of them is really close to the Masoretic. So then I went into the Septuagint version of, especially the central verse in verse 21. And that you have on your handout. Their mighty ones shall be over them, their leaders shall proceed from themselves. I will gather them, and they shall return to me. For who is this that has his heart set to return to me, says the Lord. We have in Jeremiah, when we look to the Hebrew or Greek edition, we have a couple of prophecies of the end times of David in our chapter 23 and our chapter 34. And as you know, we also have this beautiful text on the new covenant in chapter 31, but there is no messianic figure, only there is the renewal of the people. And as I read this Septuagintic early recension of Jeremiah, this is an expectation about a leader coming from the people. As in the other Davidic or messianic promises in chapter 23 and 34, Jeremiah does not use the word king, because they had some bad kings, so we can talk about leader, ruler. The leaders have proceeded from themselves, the leader coming from the people, and God will gather the people and they shall return to him, because they have a leader who has his heart set to return to me. Because it's very close to a contemporary text, or slightly earlier text, Isaiah 11, about the branch, the shoot of Isai, that will be a spirit-filled ruler, a son of David. also an exilic text, as I judge it. Now, this is so 500. We have two or three promises in the book of Jeremiah, who expects a coming ruler, leader of the people, who will be used by God to renew all the people of Israel. Then, 200 years later, the Hebrew re-edition, elaborate, prolonging, reworking of the book of Jeremiah. Scholars who have worked more with this than I have said that there are features in the text that suggest that this text, as we have it, is edited by Jews in Egypt in the early 3rd century BC, very close to the period when they start translating the Septuagint, the books of the Torah, in Alexandria from Hebrew into Greek. And Armin Lange, professor in Vienna, one of the best biblical and Dead Sea scholars around, he says that this Hebrew reworking of Jeremiah has known for a couple of generations. Now we have an almighty, close to almighty, a very powerful priest in Jerusalem, who is both civil and priestly leader of the people. In the Persian time period, from Cyrus 539 and until Alexander the Great comes onto the scene in 323 BC, there is always a governor and a high priest in Jerusalem. We know the name of one of these governors, at least from the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a governor, Ezra was a priest, and from other sources we know names of other governors, and we know names of priests from Jewish sources and Dead Sea Scrolls. The governor, he is the one who makes the coins. He makes the coins. The high priest does not. We don't have complete lists, but we have a complete list of governors and priests from Zerubbabel and Joshua and until the end of the Persian period. Then starts a change. From the now I quote James Van Der Kamp, has written an excellent book on from Joshua to Caiaphas, high priest in the Israelite traditions. And he says, and he has good reasons for it, after Alexander, there's only a high priest in a temple in Judea, there's no more governor. And now it's a high priest who makes the coins. And you know, it's the boss of the country or the province who makes the coins, not the second in command. So now the high priest is by the Hellenistic ruler, first those after Alexander, first sitting in Egypt and later on in Damascus. They give the high priest the power to be both civil and priestly leader. And we sense this also in the book of Sirach, Ben Sirach, around 190 BC, where he praises Simon the high priest that really rebuilt the city and renewed the water pipes. At the moment I'm living in the cold public, and the water pipes to my room, they only bring cold water, so I think I would need a Simon coming in new and renewing the water system around the cold. But Sirach gave him praise for really checking the water system and giving us fresh water to the city. But according to Armin Lange, my friend in Vienna, those Jewish scribes sitting in Alexandria and making a new or polishing a longer distant Jeremiah, they think this high priest in Jerusalem is a little too powerful and is using his power a little too much. And therefore their expectations, they expect a son of David in the end time. And then we have that in chapter 23 and more elaborate in chapter 34 in this Hebrew version. But then, in this context, if Armin Lange and Pierre Bogard, Frenchman before him, are right locating this Hebrew edition of Jeremiah to the early 3rd century, what then about this this Hebrew text of Jeremiah 30, verse 21? I say an earlier text that most easily were read about civil ruler, a son of David, is now reinterpreted in a priestly image. Because those of you who know Hebrew recognize the priestly sacrificial terminology. The hikrativ, lehakriv, to bring near or to sacrifice. The nigash elah, lagesh el Adonai, to come close to God, is also priestly sacrificial language. Vehikraftir, venigash, elai, kidmi hose, arav et libo lageshet elai. Who is this one who pledges his heart or pledges his life or risks his life when approaching me, says the Lord? This is priestly sacrificial language, and it's my suggestion today, and I might be the first one who says this, is a promise about a coming priestly leader of the people who will bring a sacrifice or come with a sacrifice before God in a way that he risks his life before God. And those who know the Bible knows that exactly the same Moses did according to Deuteronomy, Exodus 32. Moses said to God, okay, the people have sinned, can I come back to you and offer myself as a sacrifice? So take me and let the people live. And here in Jeremiah 30, these Jewish scribes, who may not be 100% happy with the mighty priest in Jerusalem, who is both governor and sacrificing officiating priest, they are expecting an entire priest who will risk his life because it's risky to approach, come before God. Later rabbinic traditions, they also know that the high priest during Yom Kippur in principle is risking his life. So according to rabbinic tradition, they fixed a rope to his feet. So that's the reason I kept this rope to my feet today. Not only for the cars to see me, but the high priest had a rope, so in case he died in the Holy of Holies during Yom Kippur, they could pull him out and not need to go in and rescue him and die themselves even before the face of God. We have rabbinic writings in the Mishnah that say, when the high priest had ended the sacrifice of Yom Kippur, if he had survived being before the face of God, then he made a big feast together with his friends and family afterwards. It was a reason to celebrate because it's risky to come before God, as we know from texts such as Isaiah 6. In the early 2nd century BC, and I said, this is the first text I have found, first and only text I have found in the Hebrew Bible, about some kind of priestly Messiah in the meaning of an end time figure. I see many texts who hope for a Davidic Messiah in the Hebrew texts and in the editing and presentation of many Hebrew biblical books, but that's the story for another evening or for my Messiah course on the web internet in the autumn. But in the early 2nd century BC, we have three priestly influenced or temple-loving Jewish books, all preserved through later churches. The book of Sirach, Ben Sirach, the book of Tobit, both went into the Old Testament Apocrypha, and the book of Jubilees. Jubilees, some of you know, some of you do not, that's a priestly, conservative, puritanic, halakhic oriented, eschatological oriented book from perhaps around 170 BC, rewriting the book of Genesis and the first part of Exodus. And the scribe is really charismatic because he receives this directly from the angel of God's presence. So we had some really charismatic scribes in those days. I don't know where they are today. These three books, especially Sirach and Jubilees, are priestly books. Tobit is a beautiful novel, from the Eastern diaspora. But Sirach and Jubilees, they hope for a renewed Jerusalem and a temple. Sirach 36 has a beautiful hymn about the Jerusalem expected for the end time. It's beautiful in Greek, it's beautiful in Hebrew. God will renew his people around the temple, and the glory of God will be there, very similar to chapters in the second part of Isaiah. There is no son of David mentioned. Ben Sina lives about 190 BC, he's very close to the high priest, and he expects an even better version of my contemporary Jerusalem and temple in the end time. If God will send a son of David, I have no idea, so at least I will not dare to write it, but I know there will be a renewed temple. That's how I guess it. But at least he, on purpose, does not mention any son of David in chapter 36. He does not mention there the high priest either, but the high priest comes back in chapter 50 in his laudation of the high priest Simon. So you know we expect the high priest also in the end time. In Tobit chapter 13, the second last chapter of Tobit, we have two hymns joined together also on the renewed Zion temple, Jerusalem of the end time. Again, the glorious Zion temple and Israel will be renewed and the Gentiles will really wonder and oh, they have gone in the midst. No son of David in Tobit 13. Tobit 13 has another new feature that we do not find in the Hebrew Bible. We find hymns directed to Zion, praising Zion. I praise you, Zion. Instead of I praise you, God, that you will come near in Zion, they phrase it, I and we praise you, Zion, you daughter of God, you are worthy our laudation. More than 1,000 years later, the great Jewish poet Yehuda Halevi in Spain even sing similar hymns to Zion. And one of them inspired Holy Shepherd to phrase Jerusalem of gold in the 60s. Anil Kinor de Shiraih, direct quote from Yehuda Halevi. But we found this in Tobit 13, and we found it in a contemporary hymn in Qumran, 11 Q Psalm, apostrophe to Zion, that we have in two different Qumran hymnic scrolls. I praise you, Zion. So Zion will be renewed. Will God send us son of David? I don't know. These guys are thinking, so I'm thinking about the new Jerusalem, and you can't have a new temple without a high priest, possible. So the high priest is there, whether he's mentioned or not. When it comes to the Qumran text, the Qumran community that call themselves Hayaha, the union, they expect in the end time a Messiah of Israel and a Messiah of Asia. A Messiah of the people, a son of David, that's often called the Shoot of David, or the Prince of the Congregation, or here, the Messiah of Israel. But he will be together with the Messiah of Aaron from the community rule. In the appendix to the community rule, the Messianic rule, in column 2 of this appendix, we have a beautiful description of the Davidic Messiah appearing, using a peculiar phrase from Psalm 2, when God will give birth to the Messiah among them. Kashar Yolid et HaMashiach Itam. Yolid, when he gives birth to the Messiah among them. But in the continuation, you don't meet a Messianic baby, you meet a grown-up Messiah. So they use this phrase from Psalm 2, you are my son, I have given birth to you today, to describe the inauguration of the Davidic Messiah, and certainly he needs to come to the pious one first, that is the Qumran community, the Yahan, the union, and establish his place there, and from there he will continue his messianic renewal of Israel. And of course, if the Messiah comes, certainly we will put him first on the table. If he put a table and we were sitting and waiting for the Messiah, and the Messiah kept, okay, here I am, of course we would give him the honor sheet. Don't you agree? Not like that will come around. When the Davidic Messiah comes, he marched into the table as the second in row after the priest with capital P, or Kohen, that means Ha Kohen, the great, the high priest, taking seat for the table, first the priest, then the Davidic Messiah, and then the others, after their piety and wisdom. So I will not be third, I will be at the end. And then comes the time for the blessing, to say the grace, to praise God for the gifts. Baruch Adonai Eloheinu, Mosi Lechem Min Haaretz. And who says the grace first? Not the Messiah. First the priest says his blessing to God for the gifts, then the Messiah second, and then comes the other priest, and then comes the Israelites one and one and one. So they really have a long time saying grace is all around the table before they can start eating. So we need to have a little patience. But the Davidic Messiah liturgically subordinate to the priest, to the officiating priest. Both are anointed, and God needs both of them. Then two texts, I will rapidly through them, on the end time priest. First, Qumran Levi, Levi Apocryphon, from the early 2nd century BC. It's written in Aramaic, and we usually say that the Aramaic writings, they are older than the Qumran community. And there are reason to place this perhaps as early as the first half of the 2nd century BC. It's from kind of a testament. The literary framework is the patriarch Levi. He is on his deathbed, and he then is prophesying seem to prophesy to be sons, what will come in the end time, maybe with difficult times, and some of your sons and sons of sons maybe go the wrong way, but then God will finally send a beautiful priest in the end time to restore everything. And then comes this text. He will transmit to them his wisdom, and he shall make atonement for all those of his generation, and he shall be sent to all the children of his people. His words are like the words of heaven, and his teaching like the will of God. Then the sun everlasting will shine, and its fire will give warmth unto the ends of the earth. It will shine on darkness. Darkness will vanish from the earth, and mist from the dry land. A renewal of cosmos through the high priest. That's quite strong words. Then you can turn your seat and if I... Oh, here's something else going on. The next three lines have disappeared from my handout. There is another paragraph to this text where they say that this priest, he will experience persecution by his people and tough times, and he uses images from Isaiah 53 and 50 to describe the suffering of his this high priest. Probably, even if this comes later, it's probably what happened before he proceeds as a mighty priest who renews heaven and earth. And I think we jump over the rule of blessings, a blessing of the high priest that says that the priest is up in the heaven and not only on earth, because when he is officiating before God in Yom Kippur, or perhaps also elsewhere, he's not only a priest on earth, he's also among the angels in heaven. This is the thought we find in Qumran, and it may go back to Levites and priests in the Jerusalem temple before the Maccabean period. Following that, we have a strange text called the Self-Glorification Hymn that we have in two dissections, two different verses in four different Quran writings. We have in three versions of the five copies. We have in three versions of the Hodayot, the Thanksgiving hymns, and we have it in 470, 471 and 491. So we have it in, this is a song they had in two different versions. We're talking about an elevated figure who is teaching on earth like a priest, is being persecuted on earth like the servant of the Lord in Isaiah 50 and 53, and like his priest of the preceding Aramaic text, but it's also having at the same time a seat at the throne of the congregation of the angels. God has, and I read on the longest, most elaborate version of this, God has given me a mighty throne in the congregation of the angels. None of the ancient kings shall sit on it, and their nobles shall not be there. There are none comparable to me in my glory, no one shall be exalted besides me, and none shall come against me. For I have dwelt on high and resided in the heavens, I am reckoned with the angels, and my abode is in the holy assembly. An elevated figure. And up to now we could think this is the ancient or the archangel, Michael, or whoever. But then comes his tough experience on earth. Who has experienced contempt like me? Who is comparable to me in my glory, and who has borne troubles like me? I have never been taught, but no teaching compares with mine. And teaching is the priestly job in the Hebrew Bible and in the early Jewish traditions. Who then shall assault me when I open my mouth? Who can endure the utterance of my lips? Who shall challenge me and compare with my judgment? For I am reckoned with the angels, and my glory with that of the sons of the king. The best proposal to understand this text is, as far as I see it, this is a description of the entire eschatological priest, partly in the image of the priest who founded the Qumran community, the teacher of righteousness, who we realize was a spirit-filled priest and the biblical interpreter and teacher, and also had experienced suffering and opposition quite toughly. And then they look forward to an end-time priest who, like him, is on earth, but online with the angels in the heaven when performing, praying, officiating, sacrificing. So on earth and in heaven. As in heaven, so on earth, or as on earth, so in heaven. At the same time, the Qumranites, they were reading this in their prayer book. So you have the liturgical officiating priest reading this text, and you have the congregation sitting there saying Amen, and they experience, we are partakers of this mystery. We had a priestly leader in the previous century who was online with God, and we expect another in the end times, and we partake now in the same mystery, and we are united with God. As is said also in the Christian liturgy today, with the saints in heaven, we proclaim your glory, the communion liturgy in the church. I'm soon to my end, but a few words about Hebrews. In Hebrews 6, as you know, we have a somewhat strange chapter for many of us about Christ in the image of Melchizedek. And we are now a number of scholars who come from Qumran writings and say that the Melchizedek, the letter to the Hebrews knows, is not only an earthly king known from Genesis 14 and sang about in Psalm 110, Melchizedek in the priestly tradition from the 2nd century BC is an angelic priest officiating in God's royal sanctuary. In four cubits of Qumran, a priestly writing, we have it in six or seven copies from the early 2nd century, we hear about the prince of darkness, the enemy. Melchizedek is his name, that means my king is evil. And he has an opponent, the good opponent, the prince of light. None of the six copies preserve the name of this counterpart, this good counterpart of Melchizedek. But we are pretty sure that this must be Melchizedek, my king is righteousness. And he's the angelic ruler of the sons of light in heaven, light with the sons of light on earth. Then to the sons of the Sabbath sacrifice. Again, a priestly Levitic writing, as we now have it, liturgy, Sabbath liturgy from Qumran, where the earthly choir sings in union with the heavenly choir of the ancients. And then the conductor on earth is very happy because he can conduct not only the sopranos and the tenors and the baritones there on earth, but he can also conduct the ancients up there. He must really have a great time. Somebody, I guess there are somebody who are singing the choir maybe. If you conduct, you could have conducted the ancients singing in union with you, of course, that would be something. And that's the setting of this beautiful Sabbath liturgy in Qumran. We also have in one copy from Masada. And here, in one of these hymns, we have a fragmentary reference to the priest in the assembly of God. And he is called something, then Zedek. We like the beginning, but Zedek. It's good to see that this is also Melchizedek, who is here the high priest in the heavenly sanctuary. And then we have from the early 1st century BC, the Melchizedek text from Qumran, where Melchizedek is God's viceroy, God's angelic second in command, who shall atone for all the sons of light and release them from the depth of all their sins. And he can be called godlike, he is called at least Elil, and he's probably also called Elohim in this Hebrew text. And on God's behalf, he brings atonement and redemption to the sons of light and redeems them from the powers of evil. So this is three writings to give us a new heavenly image of Melchizedek as a priestly, close to Almighty, at least mighty angel, God second in command. And we find the same in Jewish writing preserved by some early churches, second Enoch, Slavonic Enoch, where we also find an angelic Melchizedek, priest and prince in God's assembly. I am convinced that this is the image of Melchizedek that was shared by the priestly or Levitic writer of the letter to the Hebrews. Not all scholars agree with me. Those who have not delved deeply into Qumran writings, some of them still say that, oh, it's only exegeting Genesis 14 and Psalm 110. I think this old way of reading Hebrew 6 does not really take Hebrew 6 seriously when it says that what has happened to at Melchizedek, he something has happened. This is English bubble of mine here. Of, Hebrew 7. Melchizedek, who is without father, without mother, without genealogy, that having neither beginning of days nor end of life. Is that an earthly king who has neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God and remains a priest continually, lastingly? And who is an image Christ, different from the Levitic priesthood. He has a priesthood that continues forever, verse 33, and has an unchangeable priesthood. This is the Melchizedek image for Christ. So here we have also some kind of priestly messianism, but a heavenly priest, Melchizedek, that is picked up, in my opinion, by the Levitical priestly author of the letter to the Hebrews. And to quote, I think it was Tertullian, who said that only God knows who wrote the letter to the Hebrews. From the thoroughly priestly and temple and Levitic character of the book, I'm sure it must be written by a priest or Levite. And I think chapter 7 shows us that he shared such an image of Melchizedek, and now I have found in 3 Qumran writings and in 2 Enoch. Now what about then Genesis 14? I think these priests, they read Genesis 14 about an earthly visit to the land of the angelic Melchizedek to help Abraham against the bad kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, we have symbolic names. So Melchizedek is up there and he comes down and Abraham meets him and has a good encounter and it's a sacrifice. And then Melchizedek, I think, in their views, put up again. That's remarkably similar to how the letter to the Hebrews talks about Christ based on Psalm 8 in Hebrews 2. That Christ, he was God-like, but for a small time he came down and became like men before he was elevated to angelic angels again. So if I'm right that these priests read Genesis 14 as but an earthly sojourn of the angelic Melchizedek, he's a marvelous image for Christ as Hebrews sees it. Heavenly, came down to earth in a lowly position and sojourn, and then being elevated to God again. Revelation's portrayal of the risen and resurrected and glorious Christ has priestly characteristics. In Revelation 1, when John of Patmos is being met by Christ. He sees Christ in a white robe and with a belt around his hip, and this is like the portrayal of the angel in the book of Daniel chapter 10, but also similar to the clothing of Aaron and the priest in Exodus 29. And of course, Revelation talks about the work of Christ in sacrificial categories in many places. He who washed us from our sins with his own blood and made us kings and priests. This is priestly sacrificial terminology. And you know, the lamb is also priestly sacrificial terminology. So, but for John of Patmos, Christ is both priestly and royal. In Hebrews, he's primarily the high priest. Revelation says both. And then I'm wondering, my last little sentence, John 1, when John the Baptist is being asked by the curious delegates of the priests from Jerusalem, who are you? Are you the Messiah? Are you Elijah? Are you the prophet? Then you can do this as historical or as being interpreted by the evangelists. That doesn't matter. But what's the meaning of this question? Are you the Messiah? Are you Elijah? Are you the prophet? Certainly they know that he is son of the priest. This prophet, preacher, baptizing there close to the Jordan, he's no son of David. He's not of the tribe of Judah. He's son of the priest. He's from the tribe of Levi and the family of Aaron. He's the son of Zechariah the priest. So if they ask him, are you the Messiah? What does that mean? Are you a priestly Messiah? That is my only understanding of the logic interpretation of this. Are you the priestly Messiah? Or are you Elijah? Or are you the prophet? A testimony that in the first century, at least at the time of the writing of John, there was no reason should not be there during the ministry of John. There were also a living expectations of a priestly Messiah. And I still stand here as a Christian biblical scholar, trying to walk in the footsteps of my Lord. I work closer together with Jewish biblical scholars and Dead Sea scholars. And is Christ the priestly or Davidic Messiah? Some of my Jewish colleagues, they have quoted David Flusser, the great professor at university, who said a couple of times, when the Messiah comes, we will ask him, excuse me, sir, is this your first or your second visit down here?
Thank you very much, Tolant. I think we give you my thank you for a very interesting lecture, and it's always interesting to hear people that are working so close to the materials. So, Torleif is here, he's soon leaving back to Norway, so whoever has questions, you're welcome to come up here and to ask. Yeah, you're welcome. Please come here because we are recording.
Wonderful and very illuminating lecture. I haven't really formulated my question yet, but the immediate thoughts that came to me, is it possible that when David is depicted bringing up the ark in 2 Samuel chapter 6, where he's wearing the linen ephod, which makes him be wearing priestly clothes? I know that John Riscar thinks this is a very old reduction, because he's wearing the linen ephod and he's not wearing trousers, but would it be thinkable that here we have the idea of a kingly priest? And second, if the fact that we have this curious apparition of Melchizedek in Genesis 14, this might be a very late reduction of Genesis, since other people are proposing that the Joseph story also might be dated to the Hellenistic period. So could there be a link to what you said about the Melchizedek of Qumran?
David coming, bringing the Ark into Zion in 2 Samuel 6, certainly there the king has a priestly role also. And of course when David in the end of 2 Samuel, or in I think 2 Chronicles 15, sacrifices at the threshing floor of Arana to end God's and the angelic judgment on the people because of the census, certainly David also is performing a sacrifice and doing a priestly task. And when Solomon inaugurates a temple according to 1 Kings 6-8, I think, it's not the high priest, it's Solomon who's performing the sacrifices. And I think Solomon, he must have become very tired sacrificing all those animals. I'm bonded with him for very good strength. There Solomon is also performing a priestly task. So we have at least these three texts where David and the first son of David have priestly tasks. Some biblical scholars would say that this is an old tradition, and later on the more priestly strand would take hold of the full priestly office and let's say squeeze the king to his side on being king. So let's say the Pope here and the Caesar there, so to have a separation between church and state, or to have a separation in the offices. And this might be so, but you are very right that David and Solomon are portrayed as also with priestly tasks. And that might be behind Psalm 110, where the king is portrayed as a priest. In the way of Melchizedek, or as another reading of it would be as a righteous king. You do not necessarily need to read Psalm 110. With the Melchizedek as a name, as a personal name, it can only mean a righteous king. And I think you mentioned that there are scholars who think that Genesis 14 may be a late text added into the book of Genesis when they had started to read Psalm 110. About Melchizedek as a person. I have no clear opinion about that, but if these scholars are right that this might be, this also might belong to less in the Second Temple, 4th century, then we'd be very close to my reading of Jeremiah 30. So thank you for bringing up that. I need to digest that brilliant comment.
Any others? If not, I try to ask you, maybe not according to Qumran and that Cisco else, but you have in the Talmud. Also, I think it's Brachot, you have two messiahs. You have Ben David and Ben Yosef. So I was wondering if they keep going this tradition with two messiahs, or is that what we see also in the Gospels, that Jesus is also a Davidic messiah, but he is also son of Joseph. Is there any connections?
Not easy to answer that in 2 minutes, Elizabeth. In the Gospels, we do not meet Jesus as a priestly figure. We meet him, I would say, perhaps first and foremost as some kind of end-time messianic prophet in the eyes of the people. And then only the disciples, according to the Gospels, they get to know that he's also the Messiah, son of David. And as some of you know, the title Son of God would, in the first century, by Jewish readers, be understood as a Davidic Messiah, based on Psalm 2 and 2 Samuel 7. You are my son, I give birth to you today. 2 Samuel 7, he will be my son, and I will be for him a father. Adoption formula in 2 Samuel. So, in the first gathering of the Gospels, Gospel tradition, if you talk about Jesus as the Son of God, that has nothing to do with divinity, but it has to do with him being a Davidic Messiah. In John, the Son means more, but not in the first stage of synoptic tradition. Then I think only by Jesus riding in on the donkey into Jerusalem before the last Passover, he more or less promotes himself publicly also as the Davidic Messiah, based on David and Solomon riding on the mule or the donkey, and the promise in Zechariah 9 that your king will come lowly riding on an ass. And then comes Hebrews and Revelation into the picture, who say, wait a moment, we know what the others say about Christ, but there's missing something. We also need to understand fully the role of this Jesus of Nazareth. We need also to see him as the end time high priest. And I think that's the voices in the New Testament choir, or John of Patmos, and the letter to the Hebrews. They supplement the other images that Paul and the Gospels have provided on Jesus. Then I jump to the rabbinic tradition of the two messiahs. In April, Kaspari Center, we launched a new electronic journal called Journal of the Jesus Movement in its Jewish setting from the 1st to the 7th century. I'm one of the editors, and there I will have an article on the stone inscription, Gabriel inscription from the Judean desert, and there I'm discussing intensively about the Jewish traditions about the Messiah or Joseph or Ephraim. But there are other articles about this. When you come to the 5th, 6th century AD in the Talmud, then you find an expectation of two messiahs in the end time. First comes the Messiah, son of Ephraim or Joseph. He rises against the evil military forces and evil forces, and he is killed in his battle against the evil military powers. He's killed, he dies, his death is no sacrifice. After him comes the Davidic son of David, the next Messiah, and he succeeds where his predecessor did not, and he wins against the enemy. And in some of the texts, then the Messiah of Ephraim is risen and called back to life. The full story of this we only have in the 7th century Sefer Zerubbabel, a Jewish apocalypse written around 720. But it seems that this story is already there when the Babylonian Talmud is published around 600. Bavli, Sukkah 52b. Before that, we have perhaps a couple of references to the Messiah of Ephraim, but they are not comprehensive enough to know what kind, what genres they have, and they don't all. There can be different images of the Messiah of Ephraim in rabbinic writings. When did this appear? We do not know. Israel Knorr says this is a pre-Christian tradition, he is wrong. Israel Knorr University, he's the lonely rider who fights this Messiah Ephraim dying in the Gabriel stone text from the 1st century CE, and he's totally off the mark. But we might have the roots of this Messiah of Ephraim, who will also risk his life and die in the 2nd century AD. And an interesting theory is that this is a pastiche of Bar Kokhba, who perhaps was of the tribe of Ephraim, who rose against the enemies and died. And then we have after him to hope for the son of David. That's Joseph Heidemann, 1973. It's a good suggestion. But we have two images coming from the north, and Ephraim, Joseph is a northern tribe. With us before God and then being elevated upstairs to heaven. Elijah in the Hebrew Bible and Jesus in the New Testament. Both were from the north, both had a prophetical role, and both were important in the fight against the evil forces, and both ended up upstairs in heaven, and they may have served as images for from the biblical tradition or New Testament tradition for this Messiah Ephraim. It's no doubt that the later versions of this story of Messiah of Ephraim represent a Jewish echo of the Christ tradition. This is said by the best Jewish scholars of the last 15 years, Israel Yuval and Daniel Boyarin, and accompanied by Peter Schaeffer also. But it starts as a Jewish tradition, and in its later version, it's an echo or polemic echo. Also, we have a good one. The church does not have the old one.
Thank you. You know how to answer. Anybody else?
There's a question. How would the relationship between Mary and Elizabeth impact this question of a Davidic Messiah and a priestly Messiah?
I think both you and I would have liked to be there and interview these two ladies. I think we know from the Gospels that Zechariah was a priest and his son would be a priest. Son of a priest is a priest. So John, later called the Baptist, would be a priest. And at this time, according to Luke, Zechariah cannot speak, and we do not know if his wife could read, so if he could write to her or not, but I guess she had some sense that this baby is... Yeah, there's something peculiar with this baby that I was given in my somewhat grown-up age, where my periods soon to their end. But of course, Elizabeth is not 70. Her husband is a sophisticated priest, so he's not more than 50. So she's... she's below 50. But of course, if you haven't given birth and you are 45, the chances in those days are quite slim. And she, according to the New Testament, at least Joseph, Mary's fiancé, is from the Davidic family, and some say that perhaps Mary also was from the Davidic family, even though it's never stated explicit. So of course when Elizabeth receives Mary, she knows that what is in, or that you understand there is some, there is a fetus, a baby in Mary's womb. She knows this is a Davidic one, and I have a priestly one. And I guess if Luke has some historical roots for what he's saying, Elizabeth could think about important roles for a priest and Son of David in the end time. She could, yes. And we know that Elizabeth and Zechariah, they belong to those, let's say, pious one of Israel who hoped for the redemption of Israel.
The
meaning
comes is how we all see it.
Well, we only know that Zechariah was a priest. So we do not know the lineage of Elizabeth. But of course, Zechariah could have married somebody from the Davidic side. No problem with that. I would guess that if Elizabeth had been from the family of David, we would have had that mentioned in Luke. That's my guess. So how exactly Mary and Elizabeth were related, according to Luke, we do not know. They were related, but we don't know exactly how, and we are not neither sure if Mary was of the family of David or only Joseph. But there are many little questions here, but now I struggle to have wise answers.
Any more difficult questions here? I'll just say thank you very, very much to Life, and we wish you welcome back again next year in Jerusalem. Yeah, you are here every year, so you know even more to tell us for a second time.
Okay. So thank you, Elizabeth, and I wish each of you God's blessing on the parties that you are talking. It's great to have you here and great to listen to your wise questions. It's not always easy to live in Jerusalem as a follower of God, so I wish you all God's blessing and guidance and guarding on the path each of you are walking. Great to see you here.
So this is a gift for you. If you don't have it,
I got it up here.
Okay, so you can. So for all of you, you can still be here drinking coffee, looking at the book table and so on. And if not, we have you're welcome back on the 11th of March. We have a new lecture done by Berit Hillel, local Israelist, who will tell us about the first Messianic or Jesus movement in the Jewish setting. So welcome to stay and welcome back again in a month.